Hello, everyone. This is BB Does Soho on Soho Radio. The beginning of the show was such a catastrophe that I think we should clip it and send it to the Sonys. Although the Sonys don't exist anymore, do they? The Arias. Send that as guaranteed some kind of fucking prize. I don't know what. This is BB Does Soho on Soho Radio, sohoradiolondon.com, and click on culture. And we have an app. Go to the App Store and search for Soho Radio. And that was Whitney Dead. Oh. Luke.
Is that my intro? This is Whitney Dead. Luke, any thoughts?
That was Whitney. Where were you that night?
I was at home.
Yeah, sure. Mm. And Million Dollar Bills. Guess what? Our first guest is here. Mm. Welcome to Soho Radio, comedian and impressionist. I'm working from my phone.
That's okay.
This.
I see you've got the universal cracked iPhone.
Fucking hell.
Never mind. I love we're just used to it now, people having cracked iPhones.
Yeah, do you know I get glass when I swipe? I get glass in my thumb, isn't it? I'm a Catholic. Yes, I do it hard, I do it often. Comedian and impressionist Luke Kendall. Lovely to meet you.
Oh, lovely to meet you too, BB.
How are
Shall
you?
Shall we shake hands?
Yeah, hi.
I'm ill, so you've I've given you that now.
Right. What
there
you
go. Just man flu.
Oh, man flu.
Which, as we all know, is one of the worst illnesses out there.
On earth.
So I might not make it through the interview.
Well, do
hopefully.
You know what? I've died on this show today already, so okay. It's like, join in at me.
Okay.
Why are you here?
I'm here. I love you talking like a school teacher.
House of Faces.
Kempner, why are you here?
Yeah, why are you here?
I'm here to talk about my tour, House of Faces.
Yeah.
I start in September.
Yeah.
And it's a show of stand-up and impressions and singing. So I used to be in musical theatre and I bang on about that quite a lot. But there's, you know, there's every impression in there from, you know, people like Andy Murray, which is not as easy to do when you're ill. Or maybe it's a little bit easier. I don't know. And, you know, people like that. You know, Donald Trump's going to be there. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be a great show. Terrific. And, you know, Harry Redknapp might be in there as well, you know, from the jungle. But, you know, we'll have Jam Roly Poly BB. You better be there. Or even, I don't know, Michael McIntyre. He is somebody who needs energy. He needs energy, BB. But, you know, they're all in there and there's everything from Game of Thrones to Philip Schofield. It's all there.
Pip's
going to be there. Oh, we're going to be having you on there, BB. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to be talking about one of our main stories, which is can the real life Paddington Bear survive on just marmalade? And the answer, I'm afraid, is no. He died within a week.
It's loads of silliness, and I also talk about how I auditioned for Hamilton, my dream show.
Did you?
And I didn't get it.
Why?
Because I just wasn't as good as the guy that got it. But it was fine. I'm absolutely fine about it because I wrote a show about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've rewritten the opening of Hamilton with all my characters in it. And it's good fun.
It's good fun.
And it's good because really the show is about my obsession with TV and it's how I can't switch off. So I talk about all my favourite TV shows and how, like, in certain life situations, you know, if I'm on a night bus on my way home and I see a couple having a domestic, that can be quite awkward. Yeah. Where for me, I just imagine Jeremy Kyle is there.
It's fine.
So, you know, and then I'm immediately Jeremy Kyle with the Pete, and then I get two people in the audience. I start berating them, and it's, you know, and it's a lot of fun. But and really, you know, the whole Hamilton thing is the words have changed to get home and turn your TV on.
Oh, is it Christine Hamilton that's based?
Yes. Yeah.
Why is this your first tour?
Well, the thing is, it's my first tour as a stand-up and impressionist, because the tour I did before that was called The Only Way Is Downton, which I did for like two years, and I did that in America, and that was really, but I wasn't in it as, I was in it as a presence, but as my own voice. I didn't really speak. It was all, you know, it was the cast of Downton Abbey, and they were in financial ruin, and they had to raise money to save the house, and also Maggie Smith was getting married to Tom Daly, and she wanted the biggest wedding imaginable.
Diver, Tom Daly.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Homosexual diver.
Yeah, at Tom that Daly. Time, he was not homosexual.
Oh, he wasn't gay.
So I was very much getting away with it. And that was that show that I took everywhere. I took, I'd sort of taken 2 or 3 years to learn how to sort of talk as myself and do my own anecdotes.
So
where I'm at now.
So is it true that it's kind of, it's easier to hide behind a character?
Oh, 100%. Like, even doing people like Jeremy Kyle is because I'd love to have that kind of arrogance and confidence, and then suddenly I can do it, and then I can be that person for a little bit on stage, where it's not really me. You know, I'm sort of like, oh, is everyone all right? Is everyone having a good time? Please like me, please. So, you know, it's kind of, there's definitely characters that I like to get to do. Definitely.
Are you excited about the tour?
I'm really excited. I think the thing is for me is that I've wanted to get back out on tour straight away, but I don't think I've been quite ready with the right show. And the shows have been good, but I feel like this is the one that I'm ready to get out there. And I've been out supporting Russell Kane on tour, which has been amazing, you know, and playing massive 1,000-seater rooms. And Russell's like such a great influence for me. And, you know, just to get out and then now do my own hour and a half is going to be amazing, you know, so I can't wait.
Russell Kane.
Yeah.
I know a bloke called Russ Kane. Oh, the other Russell Kane.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's he do?
Russell Kane, broadcasting legend.
Is he?
You have a flying eye.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry.
No, it's
sorry,
okay.
Russ.
It's okay. How old are you?
I'm 31.
31. Mm. We've got a new rule.
What's that?
No guests under 40. can you... do you know what I love about the tour? I guess you're ready because you're bringing everything. And I always think that with work. With my life, all my life's been awful, but with work... You get to a stage where nothing is wasted.
Oh, yeah.
So with this show is the culmination, isn't it, of all this?
Yeah, it's really, it's sort of a year's work gone into this show. It's like end of term. It's like my topic, and I'm going to show what I've learned about the Aztecs. but really, it's got everything in there. But the good thing is I can keep changing it, you know? Like, there's stuff in there that's political. Like, I don't know what that's going to be like in September. I don't know if Trump's going to be impeachy by then, and I don't know if Theresa May is going to be alive by the sounds of things. So who knows?
Are you wishing death on May?
Well, she sounds very much like she's got about a day left. So we'll see. She's sounding a bit Michael McIntyre now.
I know you do. This is going to be very arousing for me. So, I hope everyone at home's okay. Can you give me where you think we're at with Brexit now via your good friend Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Well, you know, to do Jacob, you always have to think of yourself as a pompous prick. Well, I was very glad that you told me that I could swear, because I wouldn't often do that. And where do I think we're at with Brexit? Well, it's not quite the Brexit that I had hoped for, but I've certainly done very well out of it. So I'm very, very happy, but I wouldn't tell that to anybody who listens.
Oh my God,
he's too intelligent for me.
No,
it's not that I agree with him, but he's got a lot of big words that Lukey don't understand.
Oh, poor Lukey. When you're pretty like us, it doesn't matter.
Okay, yeah, you're right. You're right,
Lukey.
Yes.
How do you decide to do someone?
Basically, it sort of comes from it's something that I find interesting about them. It's something that not other people are doing. You know, sometimes you've got, you know, there's loads of people who are doing Trump, so you've got to do Trump. But I remember with Andy Murray, I remember going, oh, like, no one's doing Andy Murray. And, you know, I remember going, well, like, you know, like, his, I knew I could do an Edinburgh accent, that sort of, you know, Dumbledore sort of, I knew I had that. And then, he was similar age to me. And it was when he first cried at Wimbledon. He was the first celebrity impression I did, really. And I just remember just going, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if he'd actually been trained by a drama teacher how to cry? And that was like the first sort of thing that I said to my mate drunk, and my mate goes, let's video it and put it on YouTube. And so it was a video of me on YouTube saying, yeah, my drama teacher taught me this, the cry emosh, and that's how I managed to get everyone to like me. And that's what I put out and on YouTube, and it's still on there, and it's with a very red face after 18 glasses of white wine.
That is so hello. So basically you like you know, profiting from someone's pain.
Absolutely. Schadenfreude is my middle name.
Oh, that's my favourite drink. this must be a golden time for you then.
Yeah.
In terms of people.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, it's more difficult now. Like, I've worked with Alistair McGowan and Rory Bremner, and I've sort of talked to them about, you know, what was it like back in the day when you were doing impressions in the 90s, and they were saying, well, in some ways it was a lot easier because everyone was watching the same thing.
Because
you had five or four channels that everybody was watching, where now, you know, I don't know if people have seen Game of Thrones, you know, I don't know if they've watched that, so but I don't know if people have seen, you know, the Peaky Blinders, but I have to write all my stuff in a way that it kind of encompasses everyone. And so if there's something in there, there's more a joke about, if I'm doing a joke about Downton, it's more about period dramas than it is specifically Downton. And then if there is people who like Downton, then there is something in there for them. So I would say it's harder now, but then also there are so many people that you can choose from, but also it's so much easier to find the clips of them, because like Alistair McGowan was telling me that like back in the day you used to have to like tape next to the TV so then you could listen back. Where, like, now, obviously, I just YouTube anyone.
That's so
And, like,
funny.
You know, like, I've got to do the Tory Attorney General for the Now show tomorrow, and I get this message going, yes, Luke, do you have an impression of Jeffrey Cox by tomorrow? And I was like, oh. And then, so then I've looked at this thing, and now I've, you know, it's going to be a very low house as well. It says house quite a lot. And so, like, you know, that's what I've learned to do for tomorrow, because I'm presuming Punt and Dennis forgot a sketch for Jeffrey Cox. So, yeah.
So interesting, isn't it? And you just, and you listen for their, is it their character or their voice that you listen for?
It's I always think it's like four things. I sort of go, like, Andy Murray's a good one to dissect, because it's like, it's his Edinburgh accent that I could hear, and then adding his, it's like, tune to his voice. So he's got this kind of monotone. It doesn't really move from there. It kind of stays on that note most of the time. And usually it only goes up when he gets to the end of his sentences. So, like, I knew that bit. And then, like, as the more I listened to him, the more I could hear this kind of, like, creak to his voice, you know, this kind of, like, today, like, I've got a bit of a sore throat. So then that's, like, three things. And then it's, like, what's my joke? Because what I would never want to do is not be funny with it, you know, like, because, and then it's really, it's, it's my observation.
Yeah.
So, like I say, I was watching him and I was going, oh, wouldn't it be funny if he'd, been taught how to do that? Or, you know, but the more I've done Andy Murray over the years, I've sort of developed him into this character that's really a teenager that still lives with his mum.
Yeah.
And and he's sort of like, you know, when I won Wimbledon, mum took me to the McDonald's birthday area and it was incredible. I got the toy that I wanted, actually. Because I already had most of the toys that were already in the Happy Meal, but I got that Lego Batman. And it's like, I just like, sort of bringing him down to that, and really those are my observations of me remembering what it was like getting a Happy Meal when I was a kid and putting it through.
It's so brilliant. Have you ever done anyone that you do in front of them?
Yeah, like quite a few. Like I did Alexander Armstrong to him, because I was in a show called The Imitation Game, which he hosted, and I had to do this bit and thing, and I don't know if I'm going to do it with my sore throat.
Oh, good luck.
But well, there we go. And you know, it's sort of, you know, hello and welcome to Pointless. I'm here with Richard, and wonderful stuff, brilliant, fantastic. Okay. And I remember like doing it to him, and he was like, oh yes, no, you've given me quite a bit of bass, that's fantastic. But then he was on the rain and he was going, yes, there's Luke Kempner's tried to get me, but I don't think he's quite got me. I think he's tried, but I don't think he's quite. And I was like, I think you're fine, mate, I've got you, sunshine.
I know.
I've told him he's
wrong.
You
must tell him.
Yeah.
You worked with Tracy Ullman. She must have been a hero.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
She is so talented and so lovely and so giving, and it was really
how tall is she?
Oh, she's not tall.
Okay, carry on.
Yeah, she's quite short.
That's right.
But she's just great. And she stays in character for the entire shoot. So she was like being Nicola Sturgeon in one thing we were doing. And she was Nicola Sturgeon. And she looked like the prosthetics were incredible. So she looked like her. She's not like talking to you like about like SNP policies, but she is talking in the voice. And which I found interesting, because I'm not like that. You know, I very much like to just flip into it when we're ready.
But that's what's so brilliant about you. Mm. You just go to one-to-one-to-one.
Well, I think the thing is that when in my shows, I very much like it to be a conversation between two people, you know? So if it's Louis Theroux chatting to Owen Wilson, you know, it's Louis sort of, he's here with Owen, we're here with Owen Wilson. Owen, tell me, Owen, is this weird? Is this okay? BB, are you all right? You seem in some distress. Owen, do you think, some people say that you always sound like you're kind of surprised in a library, Owen. Is that true? Ah, well. You know, so it's like you've got that flip of conversation really quickly. And I think that's the most fun, is to be able to do that.
God.
And especially like with Downton, you know, I would be going,
from people like Mr. Carson, who sounds very much like Alexander Armstrong, and but then suddenly he'd be talking to Mrs. Patmore, and she would be talking to Daisy. Yeah, thanks, Mrs. Patmore. Shut up, Daisy.
And you're just, you know, flipping in between us as I think my unique selling point.
Yeah.
My USP.
Your USP.
My USP.
Thank you for noticing. How did you discover you can do this? I mean, I'm guessing it's like a multiple personality disorder.
Well, mostly my illness. Yeah. No, it really was teachers at school. So I would do impressions of teachers at school. I used to do an impression of my singing teacher. I always remember, like, it's funny because I used to be in Les Miserables. Yes, you are right to be impressed. But I was, and I remember, like, in the audition for Les Mis, they were like, I'm going to a different story, I'm going to come back. But when I was in Les Mis, they were like, in the audition, they said, oh, it says on your CV that you do impersonations. Who do you do? And I was like, thank God I had a couple of celebrities, because if I'd have just gone, oh, do you know my brother? But luckily, I remember doing Alan Carr going, oh, you know, this is fantastic. I'm so excited to be here. And like, and I was like, you won't be needing this on the tour. But luckily I had something. This is like 10 years ago. But it was my singing teacher was the first. The reason I said that is because like people are going to be listening, going, "Well, I don't know if that sounds like your singing teacher." But we used to have this teacher called Ross Campbell, and he would always talk like this, and he'd sort of say, "It's kind of Louis actually. It's not far from Louis Theroux." And he'd sort of say, "It's a you, Luke. You have to have a big mouth. You have to sound like you're a hippo. Imagine you're a hippo and stop reaching up like a giraffe trying to get your leaves. You're a hippo. Relax." And I would do that on stage. Like to all the other kids in the school, and it sort of that was where it became my thing. But I never thought I could use it as a profession.
It's a ridiculous way to earn a living, but
it's a pie trick. It's like doing farts under your armpit and going, I'm going to go on Dragon's Den. You know, like it is a pie trick, which is why people think they can ask you to, not you, but people think they can ask you to do it at parties.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, come on, I heard you're an impressionist, come on. You know, like, you wouldn't ask me to draw your house if I was an architect. Like,
I would.
Yeah, exactly. All right, I'll just scribble it down. but it is that thing, but I tell you the worst thing about being an impressionist is that, and I've chatted to other impressionists, they get this as well, is that people go, I actually do some impressions myself, actually, and you're like, oh, do you? And I'm like, is it Sean Connery, actually? As I thought it would be. Your name's Bond. Yeah, I thought it would be. You know, or they do Borat and stuff like that. And it's like where I very much made a decision to not do other people's comedy characters. Yeah. I do comedians because I feel like there's a greyer area there. Because Alan Carr on stage is obviously, he's not quite like that off stage.
Yeah.
But his persona on stage is real. Where Vicky Pollard is obviously Matt Lucas's character.
It's weird to do someone else's character.
I think so. It's the same way that it's like, if I see someone doing my version of my characters, I'll be like, well, that's my I've chosen that up.
We're going to give details out about the, before we talk about your Soho, we're going to give details out about the tour.
Okay.
But can you, as Cheryl Cole,
oh god, it's not on the list, on, but the I will list. I'll have a go.
It's on the list. Tell us we should come and see you.
I'm going to be freestyling as Cheryl Cole. I just have to think, you know. For me, it's my Cheryl's, I think my Geordie is always just deck. So, I don't know if I could do deck, you know, just instantly like that. You've totally thrown that on me. Cheryl, I like, that's her, isn't it? I like. Come and see Luke Shaw, where he won't be doing this impression, but he will be doing some that are very accurate. Do you want the website?
I've got it. I'll get you do it, Cheryl.
Oh, just thank you, BB. It's Luke Kemp Pet. That's your reet. A reet pet. Go to lukekempner.com and all the information is on there. Okay, no, this is not a good advert for me being an impressionist. Come and see a very bad impressionist.
No, you're
at lukekempner.com.
Brilliant. Oh my god. There's some amazing reviews so far. So, a remarkable talent for impersonations. Clearly a talent to watch. That's the Telegraph. Luke Kempner is a blooming genius. Dawn French. I've got the same hairdresser as her.
Have you?
Michael Douglas.
Oh.
My hairdresser's called Michael Douglas.
Really? Well, that was a joke.
No, that's the most
I was trying to think, is Michael Douglas, would he cut her hair in a specific way?
he wouldn't get a reach. Down, yeah.
Oh, really? I love Dawn. Good friend.
Yeah. Oh,
she is. Yeah.
She?
Well.
Have you ever met
friend.
Her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she surprised me and came to my show.
Oh.
And then I didn't see her until, because it was dark, and in the end, she came in and gave me a big hug.
She's so gorgeous.
Oh.
And gloriously funny by The Independent. So, for info and updates on Luke's House of Faces tour, go visit, as Cheryl said, lukekempner.com and follow him on Twitter at Luke Kempner.
BB Does Soho. Lucky Soho.
I'm BB Lynch and you're listening to Soho Radio Culture, sohoradiolondon.com, and click on Culture and we have an app. Go to the App Store and search for Soho Radio. Coming to you from our beautifully bijou pop-up and studio on Great Windmill Street. I'm joined in the studio by the wonderful Luke Kempner and it's time for My Soho.
Soho Radio. My Soho with BB Lynch.
Do you like my name?
I do like your name.
Thank you.
BB Lynch.
Thank you.
It's a very Soho name.
Lots of people say, you know, BB Lynch. They won't just say BB.
Oh, really? I like that. I do like a full name.
Yeah.
Hello, BB Lynch.
Thank you, Luke.
How are you? Exactly.
Before you, where are you from?
I'm from South East of London.
Whereabouts?
So, Gatwick. Okay. Born in the airport. Okay. It's one of those things I always have to say. I say somewhere and then until people don't know where it is. So yeah. I go like Gatwick. Oh yeah, I know where Gatwick is. And you go, Hawley. And I go, maybe. And then he goes, Smallfield. And I go, wasn't that where Superman was? I'm like, no. So I'm from a little place called Smallfield. It's a little village, but it's Surrey, but it's sort of Surrey Sussex border.
Yeah. Lovely.
Zone 7.
Is it really a zone? Zone 28.
There isn't BB Lynch.
Sorry, thank you, Kettner. So before you ever came to Soho,
yes.
What did the name mean to you? What did it evoke in you?
For me, Soho has always felt like a sexy place. And I think I first came in when I was about 13, 14, because, like, you know, we're like half an hour from London on the train. So we come up to the theatre and things like that. And I just used to think Soho was a place where I would be staring and my mother would be dragging me through very quickly, because I'd be like, oh my God, there's sex and shop windows and tits and nipples. Ah! So for me, it had always been a sexy, naughty place.
Yeah.
And then, so that was for me as a kid. But then I think as I got older and I worked here from, like, when my first job I did here was a show called Lift, which I did at the Soho Theatre. It's called the last musical I did, actually. But working here is different, because you realise that it's the independent cafes. It's, you know, my mate used to live above a shop on one corner. I can't remember exactly where, but we used to go to that French Maison Bâton, is it called? And there used to be a woman in there that would always, like, look after him. Where all Noel Fielding's paintings are in there. You can, like, buy them.
So your mate lived in Soho?
Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, he had a one bed... No, so he had literally a one room flat that was horrendous.
Was he a pimp?
Yes. You know him?
I do know
BB Lynch.
BB Lynch.
But no, it's my friend Greg Lowe, and he just sort of, and he'd like to come around, and it was just, the location was the most exciting
thing.
Even though he literally had a mattress on the floor.
Doesn't matter.
But this woman, I can't remember her name, and I did look it up when I was coming on here. I looked it up, and I can't remember her name now. But she's like this, she worked in this place for years, and she really looked after us and would give us like free coffee and cakes.
I
just loved it. So I wish that it could kind of get even more back of
so
what it was.
So it's about community now.
Completely.
What it is, yeah.
But I think, you know, for me, like, one of my favourite things I used to do in Soho is go to chapels, which is like, and go and play the music in there.
Yeah.
And because I like play piano and I'm a big musical theatre fan. But I even feel like there needs to, you know, the community aspect of it in there, I don't feel like it's quite there as much as it used to be.
Yeah.
Because I used to feel like you could go in there, take a book, go and, because they've got all these pianos upstairs, like you go and play piano and put the music back. But now you got to bloody pay for it.
Who the hell? What's your favourite musical?
There's lots, but can I have like three?
Go on.
From different eras.
Yeah.
I would say like Carousel by Rodgers and Hammerstein is one of my favourites, because it was kind of the first musical I ever heard and the first musical I was ever in when I was like 11 years old. So I love that show, and I love like all of, I studied Oscar Hammerstein at school. So I love him and what he did for American musical theatre. And then like Les Mis is has to be there because again, that was like the first CD I ever owned, was the 10th anniversary concert. And then I got to be in it. Amazing.
And who were you?
I was Marius.
Come on.
So that was amazing. And then so sort of now, like, Hamilton is such a huge and incredible show. And every review that gives it 5 stars is absolutely right. So I'd say, like, if I was picking from the eras, it would be those.
We're getting you on
three.
That. I know people.
Oh, really? Get me in. Okay. Although one more, actually, is... that was on at the Don Mize Parade by Jason Robert Brown, which I would say, if I had to pick a favourite, it'd be that.
God, I love musicals.
Oh, it's so good.
I haven't been to any for years. It's so awful. I used to love Into the Woods.
Oh, amazing.
Love it, Sondheim.
Sondheim, yeah. Exactly. Well, Oscar Hammerstein, Sondheim, he was Oscar Hammerstein's godson.
Really?
Yeah. So Stephen Sondheim used to live down the road from Oscar Hammerstein, and he would like go and like show him this stuff that he'd written when he was like 15 years old and get advice from Oscar Hammerstein.
And that's going to get shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Really?
But Oscar Hammerstein would be like, and I remember this great story where he was like, do you want me to tell you as your godfather, or do you want, I don't enough. That's how he spoke.
It's fine.
This is as good as my Cheryl Cole. He's like, do you want me to talk to you as your godfather? Or do you want me to talk to you as a professional? And he was like, no, tell me as a professional. He was like, it's shit. Go rewrite the whole thing. And like, and he did, you know, and he really like took his advice. And then I think it was very soon after that he then wrote the lyrics for West Side Story.
Oh, God.
Come on. Which is another incredible musical.
I love that. When we ask our My Soho guessing, what is that? Whose is that?
I don't know.
Is that yours?
It's my urine sample.
It's beautiful. I think
slightly
you might need,
worrying
might
the colour.
Need a little bit of help. when we get guests.
Should I not have said that? Have I taken it below?
No,
that?
I just taken a piss.
Okay.
I like, we ask people to think of three songs that for whatever reason hold a Soho memory or just kind of trigger Soho to them. Your first one was a track by Queen.
Yes. Mm. So Queen is such a massive like musical influence for me. It was played in my dad's van when I was growing up, and Freddie Mercury, I wanted to be Freddie Mercury when I was a kid and had like posters of him on my wall and stuff like that. So like for me, Queen is such a massive influence, and the reason it sort of sprung to my mind was because recently with the Bohemian Rhapsody film Carnaby Street, that had all Queen lyrics sort of above all the shops.
That's cool.
Which was amazing. So like for me, I was like, well, what makes me think of Soho? And I would say like sort of Freddie Mercury's kind of outlandish personality, certainly what we saw in the media, and that kind of be free to be who you want to be.
Yeah.
And I think there's a Queen says, be free, be free. And like, so I picked Mother Love, I think is what I picked, didn't I? And for me, that is because that's the last song that Freddie ever recorded. And he didn't get through it all. And there's some notes that he hit. He was really ill by this point. And there's some notes he hits in it, which are the most stunning notes you'll ever hear. But he only does the first half of it because he basically said to Brian, he was like, look, to Brian May, he's like, look, I'm going to do it until I can't do it anymore.
Oh.
And he sat down and he said, look, I'll come back tomorrow and I'll finish it tomorrow. And he never came back. So it's a beautiful song, and just the notes he hits, to have like sort of that level of pain, that level of sort of energy to be able to hit those notes, it's unbelievable. And it's a stunning song.
Oh, God, let's play it. So sad, isn't it?
Oh, it makes me quite emotional listening to that, because you do hear, I think you can hear pain in his voice, but also just, he's just incredible.
But that takes it to a different level, doesn't it?
There's just no one like him. There never will be. Like, it's incredible.
Is it true that when they when Queen have had people, new frontmen like Standing Ones, they almost have to, I don't know what I'm saying anymore. What was I saying? About they need someone to do two lots of the vocals because someone kind of hasn't got the entire range. That's what I'm trying. No, well, what's
his
range?
Well, they say that he had like five octaves in his range, which is incredible. I mean, there's been some people that have come along. I mean, like George Michael was, you'd thought, with a natural fit because his voice was just incredible. But, you know, and Adam Lambert, who's been touring with them, he's amazing. But there's just no one like Freddie. And I think there's other amazing frontmen, you know, like Axl Rose, amazing, and like I saw Liam Gallagher live, and like he's incredible frontman. But Freddie was just this kind of like, I think he always said that he's like, if I was just going to do it the way it sounded on the CD, what's the point? You know, people have come to see a show, you know, and he did always put on this incredible show.
Bless him. What do you think is the most interesting place in Soho?
The most interesting place in Soho. I mean, probably the little walkthrough. What's that little walkthrough? The dirtiest place in Soho, where the box is.
Yeah,
I've never even been to the box, but I know where it is. And there's that little walkthrough.
Your poster's on the wall, mate.
Yeah, I know exactly. Wanted. Yeah. But there's a little walkthrough there where there's naughty shops, and I think I remember the first time I ever saw it, just being like, this is just the most amazing place ever. So it was the most special place in Soho.
Yeah.
That's what I picked.
Yeah, that's what you picked.
Dirty, dirty, filthy
sexy
Soho.
Sexy alleyway.
Maybe not dirty, sexy Soho.
Sexy.
Yeah.
What's the best gig you've been to in Soho? Or you've seen in Soho?
I mean, for me, you know, as a comedian, it really has to be like the Soho Theatre. Like, I've seen so many amazing comedians there. And I think seeing, I'm trying to think, like, I'll pick someone like who's newer is my friend Steen Raskopoulos, who's like an amazing, amazing improviser, amazing comedian. And I saw his show at the Soho Theatre and just came out just like so inspired by him, even as a friend, but just like, oh my God, you've just blown my mind. And so I'll say Steen's show.
Yeah.
Day, it's called.
That's so lovely.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Were you surprised by his show?
I'm always surprised by people who I've made friends with and then sort of see them put together a show, because I know how hard it is to put together a comedy show, and for it to make it to Soho, and you know, he surprised me because he talked about a lot of stuff that was true to him, that was quite emotional, that I didn't know about him, yet I was his friend at that time, that he'd not told me.
Yeah.
And so seeing that on stage, and that was quite emotional, sort of going, oh my God, I never know you sort of going through that. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, man, this is when I was doing it. And so, like, yeah, it did surprise me, but his talent didn't surprise me, but it was amazing.
It's always impressive just seeing anyone, you know, doing anything, doing their job, isn't
it? Yeah.
You're like,
it's the best feeling.
So amazing.
Like, they're the pride,
so, like,
you feel.
They're your buddy and it's all silly and everything.
Yeah.
And they're in their zone, their work zone. You're like, wow.
Because for me, like a lot of my mates are all musical theatre mates. Mm. Like my mate, who was like best man at my wedding, a guy called Jeremy Taylor, he's playing Raoul in Phantom at the Opera at the moment. And I've been to see it twice. And it's just like, I get so excited just watching him, and just like, I'm always like close to tears just when he just comes on and says hello. Because it's just, I'm like, that's my boy. You know, it's just great. Yeah.
Does he give you a shout out?
Yeah, if only. Not yet.
Not yet. Mm. The second song that you chose was an Oasis one. So you just mentioned Liam Gallagher.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you not remember?
I
you
submitted these choices. As you're like telling me that, I was hoping you weren't going to say, "And what are your song choices?" I can't remember. Yes, I picked Oasis. I did.
Cast No Shadow.
Cast No Shadow. I think because it's from the album What's the Story, Morning Glory. And I remember listening to that album walking around Soho, and you know, and I feel like nowadays you don't have those albums that remind you of places.
Yeah.
Where like, I, you know, places like Elbow, like album Seldom Seen Kid, really reminds me of when I worked in Liverpool. And like, I just feel like this, whenever I listen to this album, it reminds me of coming to London as like a 15-year-old and meeting friends, and it being the first time we were allowed to go to London on our own. And this is just a beautiful song from that album.
Let's hear it.
Every man who tries to understand what is in his
Liam Gallagher's teeth.
Yeah, I didn't know he had lovely teeth.
Just check it out.
I'm going to go and check out my teeth, my fucking lovely teeth. Yeah.
Oh my God, I love the Manx accent.
Oh my God, it's a fucking sexy accent, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's that fucking real.
Can I get you, yeah. I mean, this is, yeah. You know, I know you're married, but stop doing it now.
Okay, sorry. I've got Manx disease.
I'm going to get you to just say a few things in the Edinburgh accent and the Manx accent, just for BB time.
Okay.
Can I, what's been your most memorable night out in Soho?
What, in an Edinburgh
just
accent?
Normal.
Oh, sorry. That was I thought that was like the game. What's been my most memorable night at Soho? It was. Do you know what? I met my wife. Well, our first sort of date was in Soho, really. And we went to the Freedom Bar in Soho.
Lovely.
Because it was the only sort of bar that I knew was open really late. And I was doing a show out of town.
Yeah.
And she was in London and she texted me saying, she'd come to see the show in Aylesbury. And then she'd gone back to London. And I was living in Aylesbury while we were doing the show there for 2 weeks. And she texted me saying, night out in London, ? And I was like, well, obviously I'm not going to go to London. I'm doing a show until 11 o'clock. And she put joking straight underneath it. But my mate was like, why don't you just go?
Oh, I love
that. And I was like, maybe I should just go. So I text her saying, where are we going? And she said, I don't know where to go.
Oh.
And I said, what about Freedom Bar? And she was like, great, I'll see you there. So then we met that night. I got there at like midnight. And that was sort of like our first date, really.
Oh,
and
I
now
love
we're married,
this.
Like
That's
7 years
so
ago. And
lovely.
It was, honestly, it was amazing. Like, so it holds a special place
for
me
and
my heart.
Oh, that's so gorgeous. What's your relationship advice? I can't get a second date.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm really shocked at that,
oh,
BB
thank
Lynch.
You. That's very nice, Luke Kemp.
Yeah, but you've got cracking bants.
Yeah, thank you.
I said bants. You know, like, and that's all that you should need. Like, I think my relationship advice is go, just be yourself and make sure that...
Says the impressionist.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I've never myself. But I just think, like, there's so many people that go, oh, I must find somebody. It's like, no, you mustn't. Like, but if you can find someone that you can be, and they bring out the best in you. My wife brings out the best in me. I feel like I bring out the best in her.
Yeah.
And I can just be every single aspect of me with her. It doesn't mean you have to be similar, but I think, you know, that trust be your complete self.
I wish there was, like, a litmus test.
Yeah.
Just spit on that. If it goes green, I'll meet you again.
I think there are some people that do
okay.
a similar test.
For info and updates on Luke's House of Faces tour, go visit lukekempner.com and follow him on Twitter at lukekempner. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
you.
Us. It's been so brilliant seeing you. Your show sounds amazing. So
oh,
we're
well,
all
please, come along.
Definitely. Please introduce your final Soho track.
Okay, my final Soho track, along the sexy theme of Soho and my love of Les Mis, is Lovely Ladies from Les Miserables.
I smell women, smell them in the air. Think I'll drop my anchor in that arbor over there. Lovely ladies, smell them through the smoke. 7 months at sea can make you hungry for a poke.
Even stokers need a little stoke.
Lovely ladies, waiting for a bite. Waiting for the customers who only come at night. Lovely ladies, ready for a call. Standing up or lying down or anyway at all. Bargain prices up against the wall.
Come here, my dear. Let's see this trinket you wear. This bagatelle, madame, I'll sell it to you. I'll give you 4. That wouldn't fit for the chain. I'll give you 5. You're 4 too eager to sell. It's up to you.
It's all I have.
That's not my fault.
Please make it 10.
No more than 5, my dear. We all must stay alive.
Lovely ladies waiting in the dark. Ready for a thick one or a quick one in the bar.
Long time, short time, any time, my dear. Cost a little extra if you want to take a year.
Quick and cheap, it is underneath the pier.
What pretty hair, what pretty locks you've got there. What look you've got, it's worth a centime, my dear. I'll take the lot, don't touch me, leave me alone. Let's make a price, I'll give you all of 10 francs. Just think of that.
It pays a debt.
Just think of that.
What can I do? It pays a debt. 10 francs may save my poor corset.
God, I'm weary, sick enough to drop. Belly burns like fire, will the bleeding ever stop?
Cheer up, dearie, show an happy face. Plenty more like you, dear, if you can't keep up the pace.
Give me the dirt, who's that bit over there?
I beat a skirt, she's at once out her hair. She's got a kid, sends her all that she can.
I might have known there is always some man. Lovely lady, come along and join us. Lovely lady.
Come on, dearie, why all the fuss?
You're no grander than the rest of us.
Life has dropped you at the bottom of the heap.
Join your sisters.
Make money in your sleep.
That's right, dearie. Show him what you've got.
That's right, dearie. Let him have the loss.
Old men, young men, take them as they come. Pomerats and alley cats and every kind of scum. Poor men, rich men, leaders of the land.
Captain, you can wear your shoes. Darling, make a change to have a girl who can't refuse. Easy money, lying on a bed. Just as well they never see the hate that's in your head. Don't they know they're making love to one already dead?
BB Does Soho. BB Lynch.
Young Money.
I ain't no dumb blonde.
I won the cup. Came through heavy on it in a Bentley truck. It was me, Young Avril, security tuck. In the back just in case one of y'all run up. One of y'all, all of y'all be stuck. When you see a young queen in the flesh, what's up? All that hating you was doing got the Barbie popping. Now all of them wanna be a Barbie, I'm watching. But you never gonna stop me, never gonna top me. Millions on millions, they never gonna dock me. I am the prototype, the pink print. And no, I don't want no frauds, wink, wink.
Avril Lavigne featuring Nicki Minaj and Dumb Blonde. Hello. Welcome to the second hour of BB Does Soho. I'm BB Lynch and you're listening to Soho Radio Culture. SohoRadioLondon.com and click on Culture. And we have an app. Go to the App Store and search for Soho Radio. Coming to you from the beautifully Bijou pop-up and studio on Great Windmill Street. Come down and say hello. If you're too shy to say hi, tweet us at Soho Radio or at BB Lynch. We would love to hear from you. So the brilliant Luke Kempner just entertained us with tales of his Soho, and in a few minutes, fabulous author and theatre critic Roger Foss will be here talking about his new book, Till the Boys Come Home, How British Theatre Fought the Great War. But first, ladies and gents, it's The Emotions and Best of My Love.
We'll be right back.
guess what? Our final guest is here. Welcome to Soho Radio, author and theatre critic. I knew I'd get that wrong. Roger Foss. You need a theatre cricket then. Hello.
Cricket? I've never played cricket in my life.
Why would you? Why would anyone
play
cricket?
The most boring game ever invented by human beings.
Golf?
Golf is probably great fun doing it, and it's really good golfing, but watching it as a spectator sport.
What's the point?
Surely it's one of the worst spectator sports. So we've now done cricket.
Cricket and golf. Who else can we upset?
Yeah, darts.
Oh, no, I love darts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because the skill involved. How are you?
Listen, I'm really feeling really good, actually.
Yeah.
I popped down here from Manchester for a few days.
Yeah.
And just wandering around the West End, actually, before coming to see you.
Yeah.
And I haven't been in London for a couple of years now, and I'm just so shocked at how much things change. And, of course, the theatre scene that I knew so well when I was working as a critic has changed dramatically over the recent years since I moved to Manchester all those years ago, what, 6, 7 years ago now.
In what ways has it changed?
Oh, well, I wouldn't recognise half the titles of shows that are on. I mean, you know, there's new theatres opening. The Off West End is obviously absolutely booming, and high-quality stuff too.
Yeah.
So I just think, well, I'm spoilt for choice. I don't know what to go and see. I know, Only Fools and Horses has opened, and that's the biggest box office revenue ever, I think.
Really?
Or before opening or something like that. I don't know what the record is that they've broken. But, you know, it's just a changing scene all the time, isn't it? And when you're in it, you don't notice it. But when you're away from it, you really do notice it. And it's actually just booming, really.
How's the scene in Manchester?
Well, Manchester's booming as well.
Yeah.
Manchester's booming as well. We last met there a few years back, didn't we? And since then, we live in a high-rise block.
Yeah.
And
gorgeous.
Overlooking the old Granada TV studios,
where,
when I was a young actor all those years ago, back in the 1960s, I actually worked in there. I thought, I can't believe this. I've gone around in this kind of full circle. Anyway, we look over there, and that's all now demolished, and there's all sorts of things going up there, and a big new art centre. But when you look out the window, the entire panorama has altered, because it's buildings everywhere, tower blocks, apartment blocks, office blocks, all over the place. The skyline is absolutely transformed.
But it's so extraordinary, because there's, you know, I've moved out of London now, but I come like every week, and even coming up every week, you're like, hang on, that's new, that's new, that's new. So there seems to be all this money. I don't know who's seeing that money. I don't know where that money coming from, where money's coming from, because the rich-poor divide just seems extraordinary at the moment, doesn't it? But we're not here to talk about that, although I would talk about that all the time.
Yeah, OK. Well, let's put that to one side then. But it's a thought that I have almost every day, because I see another block nearly completed.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, who's going to move in there? Mm. Who's going to be living up there? And who's going to pay for all that?
And who's been displaced so that can happen?
And so it's a fantastic city to live in, I must say.
Yeah, really.
It's like the second home to me, really.
Yeah.
So I love it. I think Mancunians are brilliant. They're so friendly. People talk to you everywhere, on the bus stop, in the supermarket. You know, I mean, it's quite embarrassing sometimes. They say people are friendly up there, but they are. You know, you go to Rochdale and you walk down the street and somebody will stop you about something or other and ask you something, you know. So I
steal your phone. Is that what they do?
I think that goes on too, but
that happens down here.
Yeah.
When I was what's I gonna say about Manchester? No, it's gone. Let me talk about your book. I love this title, it's such a great thing. Till the Boys Come Home: How British Theatre Fought the Great War. How did British Theatre fight the Great War, do you think?
With great difficulty at first, and then gradually, well, very, very quickly, the theatre scene became integral to the whole home front effort, in a way, and everybody in the theatre industry, in one way or another, from, you know, the big megastars of the day to the lowliest backstage people, you know, the call boys going around and all that, everybody in some way or another was affected by all sorts of aspects of what was going on domestically with the during those 4 years, but also what was happening over in France and all the slaughter going on as well. And I just found, you know, it's the first time I've ever written a history book. I wrote a book about comedy, but, you know, that was looking back into the past. But this was serious history, really, and I thought, I've got to treat this properly and do the research. So I did, and I got the idea partly through going down Shaftesbury Avenue so many times. And you know, the all the celebrations for the centenary of the First World War were coming up, the beginning of the First World War. And I was sort of thinking, well, these theatres that you see in Shaftesbury Avenue and elsewhere, and of course around the country, those magnificent Edwardian theatres, Victorian theatres, a lot of them were brand new around then. You know, the Palladium was only a few years old. And I just thought, well, you know, what was the atmosphere like then? What was it like when you were going out to the theatre and you know there's a war on? What does it feel like? What was on? What were people seeing? How were the actors affected? How were they affected by men being called up to go and serve in France? What happened when soldiers came back or actors came back wounded or didn't come back?
Yeah.
How did they cope? What did they do? And I just started researching, and the more I started delving into all sorts of memoirs and letters and archive material, and I wanted to get voices from the time, you know, people talking about what they experienced then, rather than me putting some kind of theory of my own on it all, or almost kind of constructing a different version of what happened to them. And I found in the end it was just fascinating, because everything affected everybody. Right from the start, people thought the First World War was going to be over by Christmas. You know, it all kicked off and everyone was celebrating and saying, oh, let's, you know, beat the Germans. and the theatre industry was just the same. Everybody thought it would be over by Christmas. But also, because theatre then was pure box office, so it's just about getting bums on seats. It's not about being subsidised. Mm. It's not like theatre today, not like the theatre industry today at all, really, in that respect. And lots of money's involved in all this, you know, big companies that were sending out tours and owning theatres, or impresarios that, you know, making a fortune and providing entertainment or plays or whatever in theatres across the country. So they all thought they were going to start losing money. And so there's a crisis. And then there's a crisis within weeks, because the government requisitions the railways for transporting soldiers or for transporting armaments. And then what happens is that because there's a network of touring companies that go from town to town or city to city all the time, well, of course, they're all disrupted.
Mm.
So right from the very beginning, you've got disruption going on, people not sure what's happening.
Just change the face of it.
Yeah. And then you've also got these very patriotic performers and actors, some of them very well known at the time and star names, who think, well, you know, I've got to go and do something about this. I'm going to go and sign up. So there's some of the famous names at the time going and signing up to get in the very embryo Royal Air Force of the time. So within weeks of being performing in the West End somewhere in some play or production, there they are off in France, flying all over the place and hoping to shoot down German planes.
It's so extraordinary, because my auntie was a windmill girl.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And you know, the windmill's like, we never close.
Yeah.
And I kind of guessed that theatres would be useful for like propaganda.
Right.
But not the rest of it. So, you know, because there's the escapism. And in your brilliant book, you say as well that it kind of, they raised money for charities. It's like they really took over. I love the story about an Englishman's home.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I thought, when I was putting this together, you know how you kind of think, oh, how am I going to frame all this information and all these stories, fantastic stories? How am I going to frame this? And I thought, well, actually, the theatre in Britain had been used for propaganda purposes.
Had before?
Before.
Right.
So I then discovered this play that had been on Wyndham's down, you know, Wyndham's is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
More or less the same as it was then, I suppose, with a few changes to the loos and things. But this was a play about Germans, or they weren't called Germans, but about these Europeans invading Britain.
The Nearlanders.
Nearlanders invading this very, you know, nice, comfortable, middle-class home, and how they deal with it. And of course, they're not prepared. the point is that they're not prepared for this happening, and the nation isn't prepared either for being invaded. So it's like a warning sign to the audience that men need to sign up already in the territorial army, and we need armaments, we need a navy, we need to be able to deal with all. So the whole atmosphere that's going on at that time is captured in this play, this build up towards the First World War. And of course the play became the sensation.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about this. I discovered it all. It becomes like a big, big news story in the Daily Mirror, in the Daily Express. Everybody wants to know about this play that's like some big kind of big deal, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could not make it up. And I thought, wow, that shows you the power of live theatre.
Well, that's the thing, because you kind of think, well, I think as well, you say in your book, or there's a quote, and I'm totally going to get it wrong now, but the theatre was more potent than the church and the press and the school, you know,
yeah,
everything.
Yes,
but like, isn't that, would it be like that now?
I don't I think
TV
so.
TV would
now,
yeah, an influencer or
I
something.
Know, I know. It's hard to put yourself back into another time, isn't it? And of course, while I was doing this, I was kind of partly living in the present and partly living in the past,
yeah,
like some sort of strange old codger, you know, going around suddenly thinking I'm still in 1915 or whatever. But yes, it's the power of live theatre, of
yeah,
live performance. And I think we forget that, because then you not only had the West End theatres, of course, and many of which are still here, but you had theatres in every town and city in the country, some cities having 3, 4, 5 theatres. These are the places that people went to to go out.
Mm.
Cinema's only just beginning to become more and more popular. Yeah, they're building cinemas, little kinemas and whatever they call it, little Biograph type places, some of which still remain, I suppose, you know, just in kind of embryo in some form or another. But nevertheless, it's live performance that counts, and the propaganda value is there,
yeah,
in terms of getting men to go and sign up, for
yeah,
example.
Well, they were handing out leaflets, recruitment leaflets
yeah,
at the theatre.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
So
the Wyndham Theatre, I didn't realise this, Wyndham's Theatre became a recruiting place, you know. Men were queuing up to go and sign up after they'd seen this play. They'd go round the corner into that alleyway at the next
yeah,
door
yeah,
to Wyndham's, which is still there.
Yeah.
They'd go there and then they'd see a recruiting sign and they'd sign up. It's full of that kind of patriotic zeal that you need. You need to defend the country. And, of course, they've signed up to go in the territorials. Well, it's a repeat performance later on during the war itself, when you've got all these big stars, like, I mean, some of which people will not know now. I mean, they've completely forgotten. It's a lost world, isn't it? Who now remembers who Vesta Tilly was? Who wouldn't know, you know? But here she was, the biggest star of the day in the music halls and
what
variety.
What was her thing?
She used to dress up as a man, so she was actually quite contemporary, very cross-gender.
Was she Britain's best boy?
She was Britain's best boy. she used to do these turns
yeah,
in variety. Variety was huge then.
Yeah.
And she'd come on in various guises. And during the First World War, of course, she'd come on dressed as a Tommy in full uniform with mud on her boots, with a backpack, as if she'd just got off the train from France.
Yeah.
And she'd go into this routine. I found this fantastic description of the Palace Theatre in Manchester during one of her performances, and how she'd go on, she'd have the orchestra, you know, all these places have pit orchestras, so they'd all strike up the band, on she comes, no microphones, of course, she does one number which gets the audience going and rallies everybody, then she does another one that marches, so she marches all around the stage, followed by soldiers, real soldiers, who are on stage with her, then she does her final number, marching all around the auditorium and eventually leading a group of men they've picked out from the audience onto the stage again, where there is a recruiting sergeant and signs them all up. And the atmosphere is electric.
You can
imagine
see
it.
Yeah, you'd get captured,
yeah,
wouldn't you?
Of course you would.
Literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the blurb, you talk about theatres or the theatre world being powerful generators for escapism, for stirring patriotism, and for sharing experiences of loss and joy. Do you mean by that that the productions were about loss and joy, like mirroring what was going on as the war developed, or just because people were together in the audience?
I think the latter.
Yeah.
I think that, because it's during that period, you know, they weren't really doing any kind of realism about what really was happening. Songs, by the way, very, very important. The publishing industry, music publishing, sheet music, you know, worth a fortune, totally integrated within the whole theatre industry. The songs would be more kind of uprousing and patriotic and all of that. Some sentimental, of course, like Keep the Home Fires Burning, yeah, yeah, you know, which is where Till the Boys Come Home. Yeah. Patriotic. It's not until later that there is a sort of shift when people become more aware through their own experience of losing husbands and sons and cousins and whatever, you know. And so I think there is a way in which people come together. It's partly through, yes, sentimentality, but it's a shared experience. We're all in it together, in other
words. So it was their, like, their church, really, if they were there together, you know.
Yeah, I think it must have been.
So extraordinary.
I think it must have been.
Because your first thought wouldn't be, if you lost someone, to go to the theatre now. But
no,
that was a social gathering. That was the that was where they all met.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's have a track, and then we'll hear more about Roger's book.
Thank you.
Unknown Mortal Orchestra, Everyone Acts Crazy Nowadays. And my brother Pat told me about that. I love it, but not as much as I love Pat. I love Pat. You met Pat, Roger?
No, I haven't met Pat.
No, he's lovely. No. You'd love him. Yeah. You're listening to BB Does So on Soho Radio, and I'm joined in the studio by author Roger Foss. Do you know what I want to say about your book? Jesus Christ. The amount of research and work in it gave me a panic attack. How do you collate all that information?
Yeah, I know.
And then where do you go with it?
I know.
That was a labour of love.
I know. Do you know what? I didn't have a panic attack, but I actually, about a year or so after I'd finished it, I had a stroke.
Oh, Jesus Christ. No, do you think that was connected?
I'm sure it was. I don't know. But I know, actually, it was enjoyable doing all that research, but it was quite stressful bringing it together, as you say. What do you do with it when you found it? And how do you lose it so easily? Because without keeping some kind of record of things and knowing where you've put the bit of research you did 3 weeks ago or 2 years before somewhere, then you suddenly become lost completely.
Well, it's brilliantly written and it's
thank you.
Masterfully put together, honestly, because I could not do that. It was I haven't got the brain for
well that. The thing is, you know, I'd spent years doing journalism, theatre criticism and features and things, never written more in any time more than about 1,000 words or 1,500, you know what it's or 300 words sharp little pieces you have to put together overnight or whatever, and then suddenly you've got, you know, like 60,000 words to do. But actually I could have filled 4 or 5 books, but you're right, getting it together was fun. But then working out a framework, how to frame what you're doing. And also, do you know what? I read, there are very few books about theatre during the First World War. I read a few cultural histories of that period, and I read a couple of books that connect up with theatre during the First World War. But there's a sort of academic feel about them.
Yeah.
So it's really that kind of audience. And I just wanted to appeal to, if you like, what that general reader.
Well, you're
word.
There in that. You know,
oh, thanks.
The reader
so.
Goes, yeah, I think it's brilliantly done. I don't know how you did it, but well done for doing it. I also love as well that you did do a shout out to the journalists and the theatre critics who, while the bombs are dropping, are going out reporting and filing copy.
Yeah, that was just fantastic. The Stage, of course, the Stage newspaper is still going, and website and all that. And I used to write for the Stage. Up until about a year ago when I decided to retire from all that kind of running around.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought, well, these people around there at the time, not just in London, but in provinces, big towns and cities, and they're recording very often what's happening in their local theatres, especially in London, though, with the Stage, all their correspondents around the country as well. And they capture some fantastic moments, marvellous moments, atmosphere in theatre, especially at the end of the war when it's all coming to an end. And these incredible descriptions of what was going on in, say, Manchester, you know, and I know that the Opera House just down the road from where I live now. But the shows are on, the plays are on, but the performers can't perform because the audience is out of hand. Sheer joy because the war has ended. So this great atmosphere going on in these theatres. All over the place. And it's only those journalists that could have recorded it. Of course, some of them are based in Covent Garden at that time.
Is the Stage still there?
No, they're based now in Bermondsey, aren't they?
Are they?
Yeah, the office is down in Bermondsey High Street, somewhere along there. But at that time, there were various theatrical magazines and trade journals, very often based around Covent Garden. Of course, Zeppelin bombs were dropping around that, you know, part of the war period and around that area. In fact, I found a wonderful story at the Westminster Archive, hidden away, but just not looked at since it was put together in the 1960s, which was some people talking about what it was like at the Lyceum Theatre when a Zeppelin flew over and dropped some bombs and it just narrowly missed the Lyceum. And you couldn't buy this kind of account of what happened. There's people talking about what it was like in the auditorium. There's people talking about trying to find a woman in the kind of melee that's going on. Nobody knows what's happening. It's during the interval when they'd all been watching a show, you know. And then the theatres nearby are also affected by it. And I found these wonderful descriptions of actors talking about what they did when they heard these bombs going off and how they tried to calm the audience down and how the audience responded and how the orchestra in the pit responded. I mean,
playing arousing songs.
Playing arousing chorus so that people calm down and don't panic. So it's those people who are on the ground, as well as other diaries and other memoirs of that period, that I think kind of bring it alive, don't they?
Totally. It's social it's reporting. It's proper reporting within the context of theatre. So it's social comment. Did the audience go back to the show at the Lyceum? What happened? Did everyone go home?
I think they did go back. Yes.
Yeah, I bet they did.
Yeah, they did go back. The bomb fell just outside. There's a pub next door that got affected, but I think they went back. So, you know, this is all hard to believe, isn't it?
So theatres, you talk about this, and I love this. So it's theatre going at that time, like, peaked in popularity.
Yeah.
And then you say, but became full of the curious contradictions bred by war. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's all that patriotic zeal going on still during the war, even though men are dying in their thousands.
Yeah.
So it's a contradiction between what's being presented on stage and what the audience is feeling or what they've experienced.
I see.
For a start.
Yeah.
The contradiction between wanting to go and do something and then finding that the reality is far worse than you imagined. For example, you mentioned raising money for men coming back wounded, and there's some marvelous stuff with the big stars of the time who've been churning out lots of patriotic stuff on stage, but then discovering how awful it actually is, and volunteering to do ambulance work when men are arriving at, say, Charing Cross or Victoria.
That's so extraordinary. So that's like, I'm going to date myself now, but it's like Michael Crawford, carrying a stretcher. Who were the big names then? Who were the stars?
Well, there was. We mentioned Vesta Tilly. Yes. One of the big names was George Robey, a comedian who then must have been, I would have thought, in his probably late 30s, 40s, who was one of those interesting performers that he was able to do stand-up comedy. And then, of course, they were character comedians. So he'd have these characters that he would do, but also appear in reviews and musicals. And Robey appeared in one of the biggest hits in the West End of that time, called The Bing Boys Are Here. And the biggest hit of that show was a song called If You Were the Only Girl in the World.
Oh.
And that still survives in people's memories. And
I wish we'd playing that. We're not playing that next.
No, I'm not going to sing it to you.
a lot of the productions were about the cause, you know, keeping morale up or whatever else, did the quality of productions drop, or did it just not even matter if the products?
Well, they seem to have been affected very much by austerity.
Right, okay.
Not the word used then, but and complaints in Parliament and wherever, you know, in the press, that there are West End shows, lavish shows with chorus girls in amazing costumes. And this is disgraceful. We can't have this going on when there's rationing going on.
Yeah.
And rationing affecting everybody in the theatre as well, because touring actors didn't have enough coupons to get food when they arrived in the town. So all this big, big furore about lavish shows then led to this strange, contradictory, which seemed quite funny to us now, result where you got producers putting on shows that were deliberately underdressed, if you like, deliberately billed as being cheap and cheerful.
Yeah. Although you'd imagine something, maybe, you know, lots of people, the escapism. So if it's glamorous and gorgeous on stage, it kind of keeps your hopes up, and, you know, maybe you don't want that reality bites. But let's play a track. This is Jill Scott. I love Jill Scott, and then we'll talk much more about Roger's books. This is Jill Scott and Hate on Me.
The world. silver platter, would it even matter? You'd still be mad at me if I could find in all these a dozen roses, which I would give to you.
Hate on me. Roger, tell me that story. We were just chatting about a lyricist during that time. Tell us the story.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, the title of this book is Till the Boys Come Home. And that is a line from probably one of the most famous First World War songs ever, Keep the Home Fires Burning.
Yeah.
Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning. You know, it's very sentimental. It's of the moment. It, written in 1914, the song, the music by Ivan Novello. Ivan Novello was very young then. He became a huge, huge name and composer of songs, of musicals and things. Anyway, his mother had written a lyric to his music, and it didn't really work properly. And a friend of his, Lena Gilbert Ford, American over here, she'd written poems and stuff. They obviously knew each other, and she contributed the new lyric. This new lyric actually sold that song totally, because it's so of the moment. It's so right. It's just perfect. The sad thing is that she never actually, for some reason or another, contractually, never got a penny in royalties. This became, you know, this is hard to imagine, that people wrote these songs. They were picked up by music publishers. They then get performed in theatres live by artists, performers around the country. And within days, the audiences have picked up on those songs. You know, and suddenly you find people walking down the streets humming them, or, you know, people whistling them.
Yeah.
That's how it all spread. It's not really through recordings, and, yeah. And it's not like today at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, the even sadder thing is, I mean, yeah, why she never got royalties, I've never really been able to find out. But towards the end of the war, living in North London, on one of those Zeppelin raids, one night, they dropped bombs and the bombs landed on her house, and she was killed.
It's
yeah,
with that whole era, how do you think that changed post-war theatre?
Well, yeah, that was another interesting thing, because I said earlier, we were talking earlier, because this is all very much about box office.
Yeah.
That's how it all worked commercially. But there were movements then to try and subsidise theatre, if you like, to take theatre out of the normal places into, say, libraries or wherever. And there were a few little kind of theatre clubs that performed things for one performance only that were not commercial. But the experience of, I think particularly of this phenomenon of companies going out to France, theatre companies going out to France and performing for the troops,
yeah,
very often near the firing line, in what you might call kind of scratch circumstances, really no lighting, yeah, nothing much to put it together, very little scenery. And also you had a lot of soldiers over there who'd been ex-professionals, so they'd been in the business, and they were putting on concert parties and performances for their own troops. And I think what happened is that people began to realise, well, you can do plays without, and do, you know, shows, really. You can do plays in particular. You don't need sets and you don't need, yeah, lighting. You don't need... So I think that's one thing. And then the other thing is...
So it changed the model a little bit.
It changed the idea of what you could do on stage. And also this movement towards getting more and more subsidy, if you like, mm, which was anathema. You know, you don't do that. It's not the sort of thing you do. That really changed as well. And so you've got a movement towards people taking out productions to civic venues in the 20s and 30s, but mainly in the 20s. And I think, and there was also a talk of a national theatre around that time as well. And, you know, that seemed like it's never really ever going to happen, although eventually it did in the 1960s. But there is a movement. It's very small, but yeah, it is there. It is, yeah, detectable.
It's impacted. Yeah. We'll have a track from Bruno Mars. It's kind of my boyfriend, Roger.
Really?
Not really. It's called Treasure. Wow. And then we'll have a bit more chat.
Baby squirrel, use a sexy motherfucker.
Give me your, give me your, give me your attention, baby. Baby. I gotta tell you a little something about yourself. You're one of our flawless. Ooh, you a sexy lady. Baby. But you walk around here like you wanna be someone.
Bruno Mars and Treasure. Roger, so the whole theatre scene then reflected what was going on then and helped people and, you know, just calmed and spurred people on, etc. Do you think theatre now is reflecting where we're at now in terms of Brexit and Trump and the alt-right? So in the way theatre then was political just by being there and reflecting, do you think that's happening now? Do you think it should happen now?
I think it should happen. I mean, I think, you know, theatre folk should be in touch with what's happening around them. It seems to me there's a great diversity of theatre in London in particular.
Yeah.
There's something for everybody, really. But I do get the impression that there are more and more writers, you know, concerned with current issues, if you like, without dealing with them in what might have been, say, in the 60s or 70s, an overtly political way.
Yeah.
But it just seems to me very much personal and connected with people's lives, far more than any kind of ideology or dogma. Jamie down the road in Shaftesbury Avenue, for example, you know, this is a personal story, but the politics, the gender politics, are just totally up front, aren't
they? A really interesting way of looking at it. And also, I guess, where everyone's savvy enough that something couldn't be too blatant because, you know, it couldn't be too propaganda because either way you'd see it.
You just see through that, don't you? When you're being preached that, you don't really connect with it. But if you've got people who are able to convey ideas through human beings on stage, whatever form it takes, that does actually or can connect up.
So the personal story chart.
Yeah, and I think within I get the impression as well. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm still stuck in the past, really. But I get the impression too that young performers and actors are much more clued up than certainly we were when I was younger and got into the business in, you know, way back then, before I became a journalist. I mean, you know, we didn't have that. It's not political, is it, in the old fashioned sense, but didn't have that kind of awareness of current concerns without getting too kind of freaky about it. I think I'm full of admiration for the young performers and actors and comedians or whoever that I've met, and I've heard Q&A sessions, for example, at the Royal Exchange in Manchester. You know, I just really admire the sort of younger generation of performers who seem to be so kind of in tune with the world around them, within the business, within the profession itself, and how they work together as well.
I love chatting to you, and I think everyone needs to buy this book because it's brilliant. I need to say goodbye and thank my guests. So thank you, Luke Kempner. For info and updates on Luke's House of Faces tour, go visit lukekempner.com and follow him on Twitter at Luke Kempner. Thank you, Roger Foss.
Thank you.
Till the Boys Come Home, How British Theatre Fought the Great War, published by The History Press, is out now. Go to thehistorypress.co.uk for more info and follow Roger on Twitter at FossRoger for updates on all his exciting projects. Thank you for listening. Thank you, producer Harriet. That's it from me, B. Lynch. Until next time. Stay tuned to your wonderful Soho Radio, and I'll leave you with Misha Paris and My One Temptation. Love You Soho, the biggest temptation.